Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We Zoom on Wednesday, so if something should happen Wednesday night, you'll not hear about it until Friday, I apologize. But that's life with COVID-19 and trying to figure out how to still do your job and still provide accurate information to my audience and to the country. As you've come to expect, every single day, for the last couple of months, we have been sharing the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. Don't tell me you're bored with it. Tell me you've memorized it. And the reason why you need to memorize it is that his words, his voice needs to be ringing in your ears when you go in and exercise the franchise in November of 2020. If you want to know what a patriot sounds like, if you want to know someone who loves his country, the words of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman are those words. They represent that meaning. And sadly, when he told his father it was going to be all right, we have learned it was not all right for him. It was not all right for his twin brother. It is not all right for the country and frankly for the world until we change whoever is sitting in that Oval Office. All right, now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So let me sort of do a little backstory on my next guest. And that is that I have not really talked with Rodney Ellis for almost 30 years. But that I have known him for that long is kind of magical. And what is equally magical is that I should actually air my little tiny radio show from Concord, New Hampshire, in his backyard of Houston, Texas, on KPFT. And how does little Arnie get to Houston, gets to find Rodney Ellis again, is that a number of years ago, a Texas governor named Rick Perry decided to run for president. And he only ran for a couple of minutes. But the time he was running, he was under indictment. And I decided that I needed to find someone who could talk to me about Texas and about Rick Perry. And we started a segment called Indictment Watch in order to cover Rick Perry. Well, we have never stopped covering Texas, even after Rick dropped out of the race. I am more than pleased to introduce you to someone who has been called a criminal justice reform titan. He is a county commissioner in Harris County. He was a Texas state senator for decades. And I think Harris County is very lucky, Rodney Ellis, to have gotten you at the most perfect time. Because as you've been fighting for criminal justice reform for virtually your entire life, people are finally hearing you. People are finally beginning to understand it can't just be words. It needs to be policy. So let me welcome to my program Rodney Ellis, who I met when we were both toll fellows for the Council of State Governments in the early 1990s. We got to like each other immediately, and I think we still do. Thank you so much for joining me.
Arnie, so good to see you again after all these years, and I'm just so proud of you, Dr. Arneson. You are the top talk show host on our progressive side in this country, and you just do an amazing job of getting the truth out, and I'm just so glad to know you.
I'm just so glad we got to reconnect. It's just amazing. rather than start with the criminal justice, which we have to get into, because what you did, this package of change that you were able to convince your other county commissioners to embrace is really quite remarkable. I do need to touch a little bit about COVID, because Texas is now kind of the epicenter. Houston, the biggest hospital complex in the world, is being slammed in a way that they can't even quite imagine. And I just wanted to share a little nugget I pulled out of a story from Houston, and it was by the Texas Department of Health. And I said, this is the definition of exponential. It took 52 days for you to reach 1,000 deaths. They said it will take 39 days to reach to 2,000, 24 days to reach to 3,000, 11 days to reach to 4,000. Unless we begin to deal with this issue, we don't have enough morgue space. We don't have enough refrigerator trucks. And we are talking about life and death. So, Rodney, you can start with COVID because you're unfortunately seeing it in bold relief.
Well, it's frightening, Arnie. You know, latest statistics, 57,095 confirmed cases, 537 deaths. Here's what's interesting. Because we have such a young population, our deaths so far are not as high as they are in other parts of the country. But now we're seeing, as we learn more about this virus, it even has a death toll with our younger population. But look, you know, Harris County is huge, 4.8 million people in this county. Five-person governing board, as you mentioned, largest medical center in the world. We're the most diverse city, Houston's most diverse city in the country. Harris County is at least one, if we're not the most diverse county, we'd be tied or right below the most diverse one. We have the largest uninsured population in the country, in Texas. I'd say a million of those are probably in Harris County, because our state leaders, our governor, would not just sign the piece of paper to draw down the affordable health care money. And a lot of my constituents have told me, he's a big precinct, four precincts, and a county judge, Lena Hidalgo, is the face of our court, the chief administrative officer. I have about 1.2 million people in my precinct. I'm a little down. The two Democratic precincts will have to go up. But look, I go out, I'm doing these drives, give away food. People never thought they'd be in a food line, giving away masks. And I'll tell some people, look, have you gotten the check? Have you gotten tested? Do you have symptoms? If so, get tested. And they'll say to me, well, Rodney, why would I get tested? I don't have health insurance.
Exactly.
So yeah. What can I do? And then I'm trying to convince them, you know, you can go to Harris Health. You can go to the hospital district and we'll take as many as we can. But look, it's frightening. Judge Hidalgo, Mayor Sylvester Turner worked in sync. They shut down a rodeo. Rodeo in Texas now.
I know.
That's like five Super Bowls.
I know.
Shut it down. The first big shutdown in our part of the country was South by Southwest in Austin. When they shut that down, you people kind of took a deep breath. When they shut down a rodeo, that's a big deal. And then shortly after that, bars, everything. Churches, shut it down. No crowds. That was a tough decision. I mentioned to you before we went on air, that's taking policy over politics. Everybody knows you get people mad when you do that. That's taking science over the simplistic argument. Oh, we want to make sure everybody can exercise their freedoms. What freedom do you have to wear a mask and infect, not wear a mask and infect me? You know what I mean? That's like the age-old argument on smoking. People who are against the smoking ban, look, if it kills me, if you want to kill yourself, I want to pray for you. I'm going to beg you not to do it, but I can't control it. But if you are putting toxins out that impact other people, it's important. Look, the economy's taking a double whammy all around the country. I put this on par with the Great Depression.
Oh, absolutely.
We're going to get there.
Oh,
you know?
Absolutely.
So you got both, a double whammy.
Except
a
it's worse than the Great
Depression.
Right, but except it's worse than the Great Depression. The Great Depression sort of evolved. This has slammed us in months, months. Rodney, that's the thing. And in addition to which, here's the other problem. I would talk to my grandfather about the Great Depression because he lived through it. And what we learned in the Great Depression was that everybody moved in together to save money. They all sort of took care of each other. Now, because of COVID, You're afraid to have multi-generations in your house. Afraid to invite your neighbor in because they lost their job. So in a lot of ways, it's the depression on steroids, not only because it happens so quickly, but because of COVID, the I've got your back situation is becoming more challenging because you're going, well, can I socially distance and still have your back? Can I find you a place to stay, but it's not going to be in my house? This is where we don't even understand the complexity of it.
And, you know, I'll throw a third one in.
Okay.
Now we're having a reckoning because of Mr. Floyd.
Yes.
From Houston, it happened in Minneapolis, not just in America, around the globe. We're having a reckoning on race and inequality. So everybody's looking at historical inequities in their backyard. By the way, might I add, a good number of those were created during the Great Depression, because despite all of FDR's good work, that in my read of history created the middle class in America. I mean, as they were coming back, that's when you came up with Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae. That's when you made it possible to get a low interest and no interest loan to go to college. But if you were black, you could only go to a college that would accept blacks. If you were black, you could only buy a home with that low interest government program in a neighborhood that would let you buy one, which means you didn't get to create the generational wealth. So here's my point. With this reckoning on race as we move forward, whatever happens on the national level impacts all of us, because only the federal government has the ability to print money and pay for it later. If you become governor, when you win the state house, you have to balance your budget.
Exactly.
States have to do it. My city has to do it. My county has to do it. The federal government, you still got to pay the piper, but they can print the money. And by the way, what happens when our economy impacts the world? We're too big to fail. You do know that. If the American government or economy fails, the ripple around the globe is so important. So as our government comes up with another CARES package or whatever it is, we got to make sure equity is a part of this lens. In your state, we got to make sure when we're spending this money, people who were left out of the creation of the middle class before with the Great Depression are not left out this time.
It's not only the equity. I just want to remind everyone, we're talking about the fact that unemployment benefits are going to end by the end of July. And everyone's going, oh, they're getting $600 a week. Some of them are getting more than that. I said, you know what the difference is when you give unemployed people this money versus giving the rich a tax cut or giving them PPP that they don't even deserve? Is that every freaking dime that they are getting in their household are going right out into the economy. It's going right out to pay the mortgage. It's going right out to pay the bills. It's going right out to pay for the food. It is keeping the economy afloat. It is not about unemployment. It is about a surge of dollars into the very economy. And if that surge of dollars stops, Rodney, you and I both know it. It is not just those families that are going to be hurt. It is going to be your state, your city, your town, and your country, because they don't put their money offshore. They don't put their money into a stock market. They put their money into the economy. So Republicans are being penny-wise, millions of pounds foolish, because it will not just be about unemployment. It'll be about the economy.
Economy evolves on the basis of spending. Unfortunately, oftentimes it's money we don't have, but that's what makes it evolve. If nobody goes to the restaurants, all of those workers, all of the cooks, and in my state, we finance state government in Texas essentially off of the sales tax. Local government off of the property tax. City gets a little sales tax. The county, it's essentially property taxes. Well, if you can't pay your rent, you got me. I mean, it's a nobody, the cable bill, grocery stores, and it goes to that impact in these communities of color, the frontline workers. I mean, those are the people who work at the restaurants, the nurses, the people who work in the hospitals, pick up the trash. That's why you have a disproportionate impact in communities of color. And let's not forget our immigrant community, by the way. They pay income tax. They pay sales tax. They pay the backbone of the economy. And, you know, I remember seeing that movie some time ago, you know, Making the Day Without a Hispanic. You know, I mean, imagine that's the backbone. They were African-Americans at first, still to a great extent. And we're lucky to be on the board of this country with Mexico, with a youthful population, by the way, because that keeps us going now that you and I are older 30 years later.
Okay, so Rodney, real quick vignette since you mentioned this. My daughter lives in New Orleans. So we went down to New Orleans to do cleanup right after Katrina. Let me tell you about a T-shirt that they were selling in New Orleans when we went down to help. The T-shirt said, listen to this, F-E-M-A. Now you think FEMA. That's not what it meant. Find every Mexican available. I want you to hear that. Because of what you just said, understand they are the backbone. Understand they have rebuilt. Understand they're essential workers. I've been taught by Scott Braddock from the Quorum Report that, you know, Houston has 600,000 undocumented immigrants, but they are essential. They are part of the community. They get sick too. You don't want them driven into the shadows. You want them to be tested. You need to protect them. We have to sort of understand that we really are our brother's keeper. You know, this is the most Christian thing to say, but yet we're not acting in that way, as somehow we place blame there instead of understanding how we're attached to each other.
Arnie, I'm real proud of something we did, and I took the lead on it. I think it was probably logical for me to do it. So our governing board's 5 people. It changed to Democratic hands. Our county judge, Lena Hidalgo, well-educated. She won at 27 years old, Latinx. Adrian Garcia, former sheriff, who is now a county commissioner, and me. So we did a package of direct assistance. We looked all around the country. I must say my staff and the judge's staff took the lead on it, mainly my chief of staff, Brandon Dudley. When you get out here again, you got to meet a brilliant young man. So instead of doing that first come, first serve stuff, sometimes the better prepared of the least fortunate are the ones sitting by the computer to get online. And hey, the digital divide. Some people don't have a computer. So what we did was decide, what's our criteria? Who are the people who are going to qualify? What percentage of the medium income are we going to hit? 80%, 90%, whatever it is. I can't remember the threshold. And then we're going to have these people apply. We used a call center they had in LA in maybe 15, 16 different languages. So you could call in. We put out old school mail. We did telephonic town hall meetings. We did press conferences. We let you go online. And then when you get in, we did a random selection on who would qualify. And we did not limit it to people who had citizenship. So we ran the risk of not getting CARES money because of strings that some of the Republicans tied to the CARES money. But look at the backbone of the economy. The Open Society Foundation is using that as a model. Don't do this first come, first serve.
Exactly.
Because that's somebody who doesn't have COVID, who has the time, who's watching the news. And I'm proud of what we did. That was $30 million. We did a small business fund. We put in $15 million initially, did another $30 million. It's not enough. But look, we're doing some progressive stuff deep in the South, in Harris County. And let me tell you, for this state to ever become progressive, it has to come through Harris County.
I keep saying, if I were younger, I would move to Texas and work my buns off for the election of November of 2020. Because if we change Texas, we change the world, not
change
just
the
United
map.
States.
We change
everything. And as you were talking about, it's not first come, first serve. You are so, so right. I mean, I get it. I have access to all this information. It's people in the, you know, the technology divide who don't. It's people who have to work, who don't have time to scroll through all the supports that you know exist. But this reminds me of what Mayor de Blasio did, and I have to sort of recommend it if you haven't done it in Houston, and that is that we know a lot of kids go to school, but they don't go to school just to learn. We know schools have become so many more things. They become a place to eat. They don't just eat breakfast, they eat lunch. They don't just eat breakfast and lunch, some of them go home with dinner. So it is now both a nutritional import, let alone an educational import. And they decided that when these kids suddenly were not in school, they could come and then we could get lunch. And he said, you can come. And then he said, you know what, bring your families. They can come too. We'll feed them too. And then he said, anyone can come and get fed. Anyone. And that was a brilliant idea of saying, if we're going to feed these kids, we're going to feed these families. If you are hungry, we're not going to even ask you why you're here. We'll make sure you get a meal. And what you are just describing is, it isn't the first one in the door. It isn't the one with the greatest technology. We need to look at who has this real need and make sure that we get to them. In a lot of ways, what de Blasio did, which I think was really brilliant, was understand the hunger issue, understand what was happening at the food banks, and said, we're going to open it up to anyone.
Arnie, you know, it's amazing how the mental health challenge is off the charts. This isolation, you know, we're just not accustomed to it. And that's a big challenge. I do want to, if I can, comment a little bit on the criminal justice space.
Oh, my God, please. Amazing, the package.
Your colleagues sort of note saying we had 10 minutes left. Look, since you and I sort of lost contact with our legislative careers, I think in 2001, I looked up and became chair of the Senate Finance Committee in Texas, which is a big deal. There were 16 Republicans, 15 Democrats. Once Perry went to the governor's mansion. it gave me a chance to really focus on putting some energy into passing criminal justice issues I'd worked on a long time, like the hate crimes bill. We included sexual orientation in it, named it after James Byrd, by the way, because of that horrific hate crime. Yeah. We also passed a statewide indigent defense package. You remember all that stuff about sleeping lawyers in Texas? Case went up to the Supreme Court, and the state's argument was, well, he was awake during the important parts of the death penalty trial. You know what I mean? He wasn't comatose. He woke up. But so we did something to improve indigent defense in many ways. But I ended up meeting Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, and they asked me to go on the board of the Innocence Project, and I chaired that for 16 years, I believe, one out of New York. It gave me a chance to really develop some expertise through them, put together a strong policy team. Matty DeLone out of New York was our executive director, and I could look at these exonerations and find policy issues. Use those exoneree stories. You got to tell a story to pass a bill, remember?
You do, always. And we're both storytellers.
We passed some amazing stuff in Texas. You know, now that's more to do. I tell folks all the time, I remember when Mr. Soros, one time I met with him, and he was going to pull out of Texas. Said, why waste the time? This is about 10 years ago. Sherlyn Ifill had me go up to a meeting with him, and I said, well, Mr. Soros, if you want to bring light to a dark place, get the hell to Texas. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And they stayed in. But look, when I was about to leave the Senate, about 2 years before I left, a young guy, Alec Karakatsanis, wanted to sue Austin over bail reform, over cash bail. Yeah. And I said, hey, young man. He figured, I'm going to do Austin, they're progressive. I said, you think they're progressive? Until you start messing with those bail bondsmen, backed up by big multi-conglomerates. So I said, why don't you look at Harris County? And to the extent I can help you, it's in my Senate district, off Fort Bend County, to help you with discovery, if it's legal, whatever I get. And I'll encourage people to help. He did. He sued Harris County. Then, lo and behold, a good friend of mine passed away. I ended up becoming a county commissioner. It's a big deal in Texas, only in Harris County. Staff of about 300 or so people. I put together a strong policy team. He sued us. We settled that bail litigation on a misdemeanor level. It was about, shot across the country. Most places were looking at what Judge Lee Rosenthal wrote. It's a brilliant, well-written opinion. Now the battle is for felony bail. But look, after this George Floyd controversy, there are a lot of issues that come on the table. I want to make sure we don't lose sight of that. And I'm pushing as hard as I can. I'm not going to use the phrase defund the police. That's just not going to fly in my part of the country. But I do know that 45% of our general operating budget is for constables and the sheriff, not going to the DA and all of the other stuff related to law enforcement. And how do you put more money into alternatives to incarceration? You can raise taxes. Republicans are going to run from that. You can look for efficiencies. Everybody wants to protect their fiefdom. Or you can decide you're going to reimagine how you do things. You save money if you use the concept of cahoots. Why do we always call the officers, the cops, every time there is a crisis? Sometimes what you need is a mental health counselor. If it escalates, obviously you need law enforcement. So I put a marker down of $25 million. And I laid out about four things. We don't do PD offices much in Texas. It's an old school thing. The judges pick the lawyers to represent poor people. Who do they pick? Somebody wrote them a check. Or somebody who won't argue with them. It won't do like Della Reese would send that note to what's his name? You know what I'm talking about, Perry Mason.
Okay, Della Reese.
Della Reese sent him a note. Perry, object.
You're showing our age, Rodney. Yeah. You're showing our age. I'm just telling you. Keep going.
If a judge picks you won't do that. So right. Our public defender office was created, I don't know, a decade ago, handling 6% of the cases when I got here. It got up to 12 with Democrats controlling. We made a commitment. We're going to have it at capacity to handle half those cases. Then we want to do something called managed assigned counsel, stop the judges from picking lawyers. But look, in honor of George Floyd, all around this country, I just want to make sure we do as much as we can to put more resources into helping with alternatives and putting people in jail. And when they get out and they serve that time, let them vote. Give them some skills. You know, we all make mistakes.
So let me just say something. Rodney, I love you. Like, we have to do this more often. I feel like I need it. You're like my medication. So as I'm listening to you, we've done a lot on demilitarizing the police. And I'm going to send you a phenomenal report by Pogo about demilitarizing police, because in a lot of ways, it's not about defunding. I think you're absolutely right. That's a no-go story.
But that phrase just kind of blows it out of the water.
I totally agree with you. But what we're seeing happening in Portland and now potentially in other cities around the country is really about a secret police, but it's about a militarization of how we respond to the protests. And that's not what we do in this country. So I want you to read this article about demilitarizing, and it's going to, I mean, if you don't know it all, which you probably do, it's really important. But the other reason I want to say is that I'm so glad you're a county commissioner at this time, because the package that you were able to produce is so remarkable when it comes to criminal justice reform. It covers such a wide range of issues. And what is equally amazing is how many of the votes were 5-0. You got the Republican that's serving on that county commission to agree with you, because it's becoming self-evident. We have to look at these things. We have to look at the racial component of arrests. We have to look at chokeholds. We have to look at these things. It is no longer acceptable to look away.
Well, we got to raise the tough issues. And when we can get bipartisan buy-in, we should do it. But let me tell you, if we can't get it, just raise it. Just push as hard as we can. And look, I do some of the other issues that are important. I got rid of a Robert E. Lee Road. It's amazing. That was,
I know, it's Unison
page.
Road. Unison.
Yeah. It was a front page of City State. It was a three block road. But you know what? We also canceled this Omni contract that had holds on 25,000 people for ridiculous little minor offenses and couldn't get their driver's licenses. They got no press. So I'm going to do some of the stuff that just make sure it's not only the feel good stuff that's borderline cosmetic. You got me? Make sure it's substantive policy changes. I mean, do the name changes. I'm going to do that. I'm going to come up with something. I don't want that Confederate flag out at the rodeo. I'll do all of that. But I'm going to make sure I do those things and have substantive policy changes that will last beyond my tenure in public office. Arnie, I love you.
So I love you. Let me just give you one idea of what he means by substantive. There has to be a report on the effects of criminal fines, fees, and cash bail on vulnerable communities, including low-income and racial and ethnic minority groups. It's not just the report you want. You want the empirical data and said, this needs to be changed. Now you can't say you don't know the numbers. This is the effect. What are we doing to change it? Rodney Ellis, I love you. I knew when I met you in the early 1990s that I was going to fall in love with you. I didn't realize it would take 30 years for me to find you again, but we will do this again. Thank you so much. And we will clone your ideas. You're absolutely right. We have to do it, but we'd never do it in isolation. Good ideas need to be replicated. And you are at the center of good ideas. Rodney Ellis, County Commissioner, Harris County, a criminal justice reform titan. I am so pleased to have you on with me.
I'm looking forward to getting back to New Hampshire. I miss it.
Well, I miss you. Take care. Mwah. Bye-bye. All right, everyone, stick around. A little more radio when we get back.
A superhighway for aquatic invaders on this current cast. When locks and canals began allowing ocean-going vessels to bypass Niagara Falls, they did more than open new trade routes to the west. Suddenly,
things like sea lamprey and the alewives were able to swim around Niagara Falls and get into Lake Erie, then the upper Great Lakes, too.
Tim Campbell of the University of Wisconsin Extension says other invasive species were carried in by ship.
Things like zebra mussels and spiny water fleas, round gobies, a lot of the really big-name invaders came in through ballast water.
It's easy for new species to hitch a ride on smaller boats, too, and spread from one place to another. So to help slow them down, boaters should clean, drain, and dry their boats between waterways. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
Generates hate, and when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah. madness is what you demonstrate, and that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all.
People
y'all.
Killing, people dying, children hurt, and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach, and would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us, send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning, where is the love?
Where is the love? Where is the love?
Where is the love?
It just ain't the same, always new change. New days are strange, is the world insane? If love and peace is so strong, why are the pieces of love that don't belong? Nations dropping bombs, chemical gases filling lungs of little ones with ongoing suffering as the youth are young. So ask yourself, is the loving really gone? So I could ask myself, really what is going wrong in this world that we living in? People keep on giving in, making wrong decisions, only visions of them dividends. Not respecting each other, denying thy brother. A war's going on, but the reason's undercover. The truth is kept secret, it's swept under the rug. If you never know truth, then you never know love. What's the love, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
Or where's the truth, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
Or where's the love, y'all?
People killing, people dying, children hurt and you hear them crying. When you practice what you preach, and would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us. Send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning. Where is the love?
Where is the love? Where is the love?
Where is the love? The love, the love.
I feel the weight of the world on my shoulder. As I'm getting older, your people get colder. Most of us only care about money making. Selfishness got us following the wrong direction. Wrong information always shown by the media. Negative images is the main criteria. Infecting the young minds faster than bacteria. Kids wanna act like what they see in the cinema. Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to the fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity. Lack of understanding leading us away from unity. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling under. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling down. It's no wonder why sometimes I'm feeling under. Gotta keep my faith alive till love is found. Now ask yourself,
where is the love? Where is the love? Where is the love?
Father, 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 help us. Send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning. Where is the love?
Sing with me, y'all.
One word, one word. We only got one word, one word. That's all we got. One word, one word. And something's wrong with it.
Yeah.
Something's wrong with it.
Yeah.
Something's wrong with the good word, word. Yeah. We only got one word, one word. That's all we got. One.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder, we are Zooming on Wednesday morning. It is Life with COVID-19. So I have been banging the drum, more than banging the drum, about mask wearing since about the end of March, okay? And I've been saying that it should be mandatory mask wearing. Maybe in part it was because I've lived through COVID-19 since it was first experienced in China, in Wuhan, because I saw what was happening in China because of my daughter who lives in Shanghai. And I began to understand the nature of this pandemic, and her fear became my fear. Mine was fear for her, not fear for me. Well, now I'm into, you know, COVID-19 par deux, and now it's fear for me and fear for my community and fear for the world. I've been talking about mask wearing for a long time, and I have said it should not be voluntary. It should be an obligation. Because this is not about protecting me. It is about protecting all of us. It is very, very different. This is not a selfish thing to do. This is a community and national thing to do. This is the most patriotic thing you can do because you need to have each other's backs. So of course, since I've been on this mask kick for a long time, I see this article entitled, "Requirements for People to Wear Masks in Public Are Similar to Smoking Bans." Both tobacco smoke and COVID-19 are air-based health hazards to workers who may be exposed to them for hours on end. Requiring that members of the public wear masks is a form of workplace protection. Amen. Joining us right now are two of the individuals that are behind this report. Michael, is it Vulo? How do you pronounce your last name? Vulo is a professor of sociology, and he's also being joined by Vincent Rossigno.
Rossigno,
also a professor of sociology. Are you both at Ohio State?
Am I correct? We are.
Yes.
You both are. Well, totally appropriate that we should have you here. Your Speaker of the House, by the way, has now been arrested. So I just want to make sure
we know.
You know, I just actually posted that because I wanted people to know that, you know, as we're talking Ohio, here's a sidebar story. You know, nothing ever gets exciting. You talked about this as really sort of a workplace, worker safety issue. And it absolutely is. As I go into this discussion, I just want to remind you that the reason why I want government to order this as a mandate across the board for the state is that in a lot of ways, it kind of supports what employers are trying to do. And I don't just mean employers in the workplace where they can obviously control their employees, but when it comes to customers coming in, when it comes to other people, it is more challenging for them to be able to sort of say, you know, no shirt, no shoes, no mask, no service, because they don't have that sort of muscle of the government behind them. Let's talk about this idea of this workplace safety, because I think it is so important, and it really sort of emphasizes why until we find a vaccine, until we find some kind of really effective treatment like we see with HIV that we all have access to, let me remind you, it is not the treatment, it is not the vaccine I give a crap about, it's whether everybody gets it that's going to matter. Michael, you're the one that I've sort of seen the most. I apologize, Vincent, but let's start with Michael because that's really how I sort of backed into this article. And let's talk about your perspective, both as sociologists and the people that have studied this issue, that you were really prepared for the COVID-19 conversation about masks.
Yeah, so let's start with sort of the underlying logic of our article, which is that, you know, the underlying argument against masks is that it's a violation of individual rights and liberties. But what people kind of forget is that there's a balance of individual rights and liberties that, you know, my own liberties might inflict harm on someone else. And so there is a limit. Even the strictest political philosophies that favor individual rights over state intervention, like libertarianism, still recognize that the limit of those rights are harms to others. And so that is part of the underlying logic behind smoking bans, is that if you allow people to smoke in indoor spaces, that it could harm others. And we have a history of recognizing that workers have rights to a healthy work environment. And so that's really sort of the hook where you can say we have a precedent for requiring masks indoors because we recognize that the rights of workers, in some sense, can override those of the patrons.
So Vincent, as I'm listening to you, I come from a very libertarian state, by the way. This is Live Free or Die, New Hampshire. It's the home of the Free State Project, where a bunch of libertarians decide to move here and take over and then dismantle our government. So libertarian is really sort of in our DNA. Oy, oy, oy. As I'm listening to Michael, one of the things I think is interesting is let's talk about the smoking ban. We're first told by the tobacco industry that it didn't cause cancer. We knew that they knew it, but they hid it. And then eventually the science came out. And the science said, hey, you know what? There's a connection to smoking and cancer. Then the science got even more refined, and we started learning about secondary smoke effects on people who never picked up a cigarette. And the reason I mentioned the science refining and the science becoming more understanding of the effects, not just on the individual, but on the family and the workplace, is that as we learn from the science, we changed our behavior and we changed our expectations, which is why the smoking ban. And that goes directly to what's happening right now with COVID-19. We are learning. Let's understand this. This is a new pandemic. We are learning on the job, and we must be able to give people the flexibility to change, to enforce, and to protect.
I agree. And, you know, the fact is there's already pretty decent science on COVID-19. It hasn't taken as long as it has for smoking. We know how it's transmitted. We know how easily it's been transmitted. And in some ways, the way it's transmitted is more frightening, more deadly than tobacco smoke, let's say in a restaurant or a bar. You can see somebody smoking. You could potentially avoid them spatially. We don't know in the case of COVID-19 whether or not this person who otherwise looks healthy, who walks into our restaurant, who walks into our grocery store, is transmitting the sickness. We know that from the get-go. And back to Mike's point about worker safety, we actually have a bureaucracy that was set up under a Republican administration called the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, whose main mandate is to protect the safety and health of workers in the American workplace. Like the federal government, OSHA has been relatively quiet in this regard. What are they looking out for the rights of workers in this environment? So smoking bans, or if you go back way back in U.S. history, there are instances of, you know, chemicals on the job, dangerous machinery, et cetera. And OSHA was set up precisely to provide this kind of leverage for employers or an oversight of employers to engage in good practices for their workers.
So let me read between the lines here. So Michael, is Vince saying that OSHA is not necessarily using its enforcement power to require mask wearing? So I don't care what Donald Trump is saying. I don't care what the governor of Florida is saying. I don't care what the governor of Georgia is saying. Does OSHA have right now the capacity, given what Vincent just said, to say every workplace needs to make this basically the framework for being able to keep your place of employment open because of the nature of this illness, because of how it is shared, not only with fellow workers, not only with customers, but let's be honest, you bring the sucker home. So this has a ripple effect that's incredible. And if nothing else, if OSHA did its job, then, you know, who cares what Donald Trump is saying? Because they're a federal agency. They cover all 50 states and the territories. We could be doing this right now.
It's certainly likely. I would say it's possible that that would be challenged in court, but it's certainly likely in terms
of the way
their mandate is worded. In the case of the smoking bans, they have been challenged in court, and they've never been defeated. They use the language when they pass them. It's the Ohio Smoke-Free Workplace Act, right? It's not like the Secondary Smoke Act. It's the Workplace Act. And in fact, that was challenged in Ohio Supreme Court. It was unanimously upheld, and it was defended in that case by then Attorney General, now Governor Mike DeWine, who has said the constitutional rights of the workers are constitutionally override that of the smokers.
As we're looking at this issue, how did you not only build your case, but what do we need to have in front of us to take your article, to take your work at Ohio State and begin to sort of make people understand the idea that this isn't a liberty issue. This is not a liberty issue. Again, you know, you can't scream fire in a crowded theater. Why? Because the consequences of that are, you know. And so we know where my free speech right ends. We know where my liberty ends. And my liberty ends when your behavior kills me. I'm just going to put it bluntly. And, you know, Vincent, and that's why I'm trying to figure out how to empower people, empower government. I mean, I know Donald Trump, maybe he is, you know, on a death watch and he doesn't care about life and death, but the rest of us do, even Republicans, even Republican governors. And this seems to be so obvious. And the whole sort of workplace issue is seems to be the best place to sort of attack it because everybody wants the economy to open, Vincent.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, but legislators have been talking about sort of requiring workers to go back to work to get off unemployment or their unemployment benefits, but at the same time not mandating masks for customers, which seems to be a terrible contradiction. You're asking workers to go back, in fact, prodding them to go back to work in an unsafe environment. And I think that tension, if you're asking them.
No, you're bribing them. You're bribing them to go back. Let's call it what it is. It's a freaking bribe. Once you put money on the table and say, if you don't behave the way I want you, I'm taking the cash away. That's called a bribe. I hate these nice words we use. I'm sick of it because they're not using nice techniques. They're bribing people. They're threatening people. They're sending in secret police. We can't use words that are rational for these people who are doing things that are frankly very, very frightening and should be considered almost illegal, Vincent.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the damage and the populations that are going to be most affected if mandates are not put in order, and we spell this out in the article, are, you know, lower wage employees that work in frontline service sector jobs, minority employees that we know are disparately concentrated in those jobs. And come the fall, if we're talking about teaching and schools, it's going to be disproportionately women that are disproportionately vulnerable to these if nothing's done about it.
I'm the daughter of two public school teachers. My father was a teacher of the year in New York City. So like, I was like, it's a, and you know what the saddest thing is? And I'm going to, I'm sort of doing a little sidebar here, but as I was flying off to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, and my dad was sitting next to me, my dad was just this amazing revered teacher in New York City. My dad said to me, what do you want to be when you grow up? And so we're having this conversation. And the one thing he said is, whatever you do, don't become a teacher. Can you imagine? A man I totally adored said, don't become a teacher. In part, it was because he thought that the profession was being less valued. They didn't understand how crucial it was, not just to education, but to the economy, to a vibrant future. They didn't see it was pivotal. Well, COVID-19 has showed us everything about education. Nobody wants their kids at home because they can't handle them at home. Nobody can figure out how to educate their kid at home. The technology divide means some people can be educated at home and others can't. We are afraid to send them to school because they're not safe. So what do educators do, given what you just said about OSHA, it's really, really interesting. They have a lot of arguments about a safe environment, and it ain't just about masks, Michael.
No, that's fair. I would say the environment of school is a difficult one. I mean, we are at the university level. We're certainly confronting this as well when you're asking a lot of young adults to come back to congregate with one another. And, you know, we say that it's partially because they want the college experience, but, you know, the college experience is kind of risky in terms of COVID-19 spread. So I don't think there's an easy answer in terms of schools. But, and back to Vinny's point about the people who work there, it's the teachers who are disproportionately women, and it's the staff who are support staff who are, again, disproportionately lower wage workers. And even if those teachers are and staff themselves are healthy, they go back to communities that are disproportionately lower class and made up of racial ethnic minorities who will then, you know, it would spread in those communities. So again, it's an issue of inequality as well.
You know, Vincent, it's not just inequality. I mean, so I was talking with Rodney Ellis, who was talking about Houston. We're talking about the COVID numbers, which are just incredible, and the number of uninsured, the highest, you know, I think, in probably all of Texas happens to be in the Houston area. So there is a connection between how they start healthy or unhealthy, where they live healthy or unhealthy, the kind of food they eat, the kind of pollution they have. But here's the kicker, Vincent. Not only do we know that the potential for spread is something that I would worry about as a mother, but if I were a teacher, or more likely than not, if I was the custodian or someone in a lower paying job, I used to be jealous of a lot of my Italian friends. And the reason I was jealous of them was, no, listen to why, was because nonna lived in the house, zia lived in the house, Cucino lived in the, I mean, it was everybody. The house was like three floors. Every floor had a different family generation. I mean, there were like five women that started at 2 months and went up to like 92 and were still wearing black, you know? I mean, it's just amazing. And I bring that up because that may have changed a little when we created the nuclear family because of jobs. So that was not possible for me. So my grandparents lived in, you know, in different cities. My children's grandparents lived in different states. But when it comes to low-income minority communities, it is the exact opposite. They live together. They live together in order to save money. They live together because they take care of each other. They live together because it just makes sense on both a social level and an economic level. So when you're looking at the school setting, it isn't just about bringing it home. It is about bringing it to six homes in one house. In one house. And I think, again, where people are missing the boat here is that, you know, I'm privileged to know how to protect myself, but they are more vulnerable just by the nature of how they live and what they will be basically sort of subject to. Vincent?
Absolutely. I mean, we already know that the spread of COVID-19 is happening in more rapid ways in more highly densely populated areas, which tend to be poor areas, apartment complexes. We're imagining right now at Ohio State dorms, people packed together in a singular building, sharing the same elevator staircase. bathrooms, et cetera. So really this, it shouldn't come as a surprise to us, given what we know about how this spreads, that it does spread so rapidly, particularly in densely populated communities and in, you know, multi-generational family units, et cetera. Especially when there are no options. I mean, what are the options? I mean, are the options to like, okay, we're going to move grandpa out of the house and pay for their rent somewhere else? Or, you know, it's a really difficult situation for everyone.
And we're looking at the idea of that it really is a worker safety issue. And that I'm looking to OSHA. Where are you, OSHA? Oh, I forgot, it's the Trump administration. Anyway, but I'm looking for guidance somewhere. And that to me seems to be really important guidance. But I'm really in a way surprised that we're seeing a number of employers, Walmart, Costco, Target, they're finally belling up to the bar. And the reason I have to be honest with you, I'm so happy about, I've never said anything nice about Walmart in my life. I'm going to say something really nice about Walmart. And what I'm going to say about Walmart is I am so glad they were one of the first big boys to step up on this issue. Do you know why? Because the demographic they serve is the Trump demographic. It's the NASCAR folks. It's the Trump demographic. It's the Confederate flag folks. It's the libertarians. It's the guys with the guns in the back of their pickup trucks. And they're the ones that stepped up first and in a lot of ways gave a lot of employers cover. They really, really did. So I am so grateful to Walmart for having done that. But I'm just trying to figure out how we use the business community to force government to support them. You see, they're doing it, but they don't have the government mandate. And in a way, the government mandate just reinforces what they're doing and actually protects the employer.
Well, you said the right word. You said reinforces. And you know, one thing as sociologists that we like to talk about is social norms. And honestly, like with smoking, it wasn't as if they had to send in a bunch of police to actually get people not to smoke in indoor settings. We did a lot of that ourselves, right? When people would smoke in a place where they weren't supposed to, we had no problem, or the business owner, who was the one who would actually get the penalties, had no problem saying you can't smoke here. And so that does provide reinforcement in the sense that business owners who otherwise wouldn't want to confront their customers can then say, look, we're going to get fined. You know, we could put the penalty like smoking bans the way that it was for businesses for mask wearing and say, you know, you can't not wear a mask here. I'll get a penalty
exactly
as a business for doing that. And, you know, not to undermine what the underlying logic behind the big corporations doing this is, we know that healthy workplaces actually have increased worker productivity. I'm not saying they're doing it for selfish reasons. They honestly probably
are. Well, they are. I mean, they're not enlightened in that way. They are, however, looking at their bottom line. Mm-hmm. And in the end, when you're looking at profit and you're looking at profitability and you're looking at an economy that's tanking and you're trying to figure out what it is I can do to shore up my business, to protect my line of income, it turns out, that wearing a mask is actually a good thing. And let me just ask one more question before I let you guys go, though, Vincent. And that is that the other reason I want government to do something is that right now, so there's an idea of somehow protecting people who contract COVID at the workplace or whatever and giving them some kind of legal immunity, all right? We don't need it if everyone is sort of behaving the way the science of the moment says. So if the science changes and they didn't do it, it's not their fault. They did what they were supposed to do at the time that they initiated the, you know, whatever it is. I want government to mandate mask wearing because there are a lot of people. I do a conservative radio show, believe it or not, every Friday. And they get ready for me when I come on the air. So they're like ready to sort of beat me up. So some guy goes, I can't wear a mask on you. He goes, when I was a child, my mother covered my mouth. And I have all these sort of, I fall apart mentally. I get abusive. I mean, it's going to, and so I'm listening to him talk. This is on the radio. I'm going, wow. I said, I hope you're getting therapy for this. I just want to make sure. But he was saying he cannot wear a mask. From his emotional fragility and his reaction to mask wearing, he cannot wear a mask. I said, okay, maybe this is true. So here's the deal. What do you need? Tell the store owner, have him deliver it on the front of a store. Just don't go in. You don't need to go in to buy the bananas. You just need bananas. Am I right? I said, let me just say something. I'm also worried about your health. You know, you scare me by not wearing a mask. But guess what? Your emotional reaction to whatever happened to when you were, you know, 4 years old is now also going to impact your health. So I hope you can socially isolate. I hope you have a home in the woods. And I just hope everybody delivers stuff to you. I said, so therefore, you cannot wear your mask and you can sort of live on your island. But here's the problem. Once you come into this sort of public setting, you are now not just about you. So the other reason why I like the idea of government doing it is that when you say to someone, you must wear a mask, and it's just the employer that's doing it, if they claim a disability, right, you are restricted in the number of things you can say to sort of challenge that. But if you have government behind you, I think, Vincent, you have more authority to sort of push back a little bit more than just say, okay. And that's my big concern, Vincent.
Absolutely. I mean, I would add to that, you know, the benefits of a top-down at the federal level or a state level mandate is it also removes responsibility for policing from frontline workers. I mean, you've seen, everybody has seen these sort of, viral videos of the Costco employee in, you know, a shouting match trying to argue with this customer that you have to wear a mask in here. It is the company rule. I mean, frontline employees, number one, they don't make enough money. Number two, their health is in potential danger. And three, you're asking them to confront a volatile, potentially volatile, angry crowd of people who have a variety or will invoke a variety of explanations or excuses for why they're not wearing a mask. If it's a top, you know, governmental mandate, they have no choice.
You're after Michael, but I mean, Vincent, but Michael, as I'm listening to you, so I only have a few minutes left. I would love someone to do a study of this. I want to know how many of the people that are not wearing masks are carrying a weapon. No. I am dead serious here, because we know the proliferation of guns is nuts, right? It's nuts. And the problem is, if someone is offended and has this sort of libertarian streak and suddenly embraces the First Amendment, I have a funny feeling they're sleeping with the Second Amendment. And nobody has made that connection. And I think it's really important to make the connection, because it goes directly to what Vincent said. How can I send in a frontline worker to tell someone who's not wearing a mask that they have to put on a mask? I am not only terrified of my health because I have to confront someone who's not wearing a mask, I'm terrified because they may also have another reaction. And the other reaction is, because they are weaponized, they make the decision that this is where they go next. Because they don't use words, they use weapons.
Well, I'll get back to the having a mandate actually giving the business coverage, so that way the frontline workers wouldn't have to be the ones that would have to step up.
Call the cops.
And say it. They could call the cops. The business owner can be the one that steps in. But also, if you pass a mandate, it applies everywhere. Right now, you have a hodgepodge of businesses that do and don't. So people can, you know, claim, well, I'll just go somewhere else. But, or you could go somewhere else. But the workers can't go somewhere else, first of all. And second of all, if you have it everywhere, then that person doesn't really have much of a leg to stand on in terms
of choice. Exactly. So the title of the article that drove me to these two professors from Ohio State. So when COVID is over, you might want to consider Ohio State University. Yeah, of course, that their Speaker of the House is in jail, but never mind. Anyway, the title was Requirements for People to Wear Masks in Public Are Similar to Smoking Bans. It led us into just a whole host of conversations. Vincent and Michael, thank you so much. There's so much to think about. And I hope the next time I talk to you, everybody will be wearing a mask and we'll be moving on to another issue. I truly appreciate it.
Of course.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You better-